It's 1700 hours universal time. You're listening to Radio France International. I'm Richard Walker. Welcome to this hour of news and features from the French capital. First, the headlines. France advises its nationals to leave Côte d'Ivoire as one French soldier is seriously injured while protecting departing French citizens. This as 1,000 protesters gather in Abidjan Airport to block the arrival of new Prime Minister Seydou Diarra. A court in Maputo, Mozambique, sentences six men for the murder of a prominent journalist 2 years ago. Five people are killed and several injured as bandits raid several commercial buses in northern Nigeria. And Iraq says majority support at the United Nations for more weapons inspections is a resounding failure for the United States. Those are the headlines coming up after the news. Today in France with David Page looks at French and European attitudes towards a US-led attack on Iraq. Willy Niebuhr will be here with sports news. And after the half hour, World Tracks penetrates the worlds of Wai and Zong. Those are two bands from the islands threatened with the extinction of their indigenous music cultures. Stay tuned to RFI. France has advised its nationals to leave Côte d'Ivoire after a wave of anti-French riots over a peace accord reached in Paris. French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin said the Ivorian president was responsible for the security of French and all foreigners in Côte d'Ivoire. This comes after French soldiers deployed to protect departing French nationals clashed with pro-Gbagbo supporters at Abidjan Airport. Correspondent Christy Okodua reports from Abidjan.
About 1,000 young Ivorians invaded the runway of the newly renovated Abidjan Airport this morning to prevent Prime Minister Seydou Diarra from landing. Ivorian security forces were incapable of clearing the protesters out, so the French army stepped in, and during the ensuing scuffle, a French soldier was seriously injured. French nationals fleeing the violence of the past week were booed and jeered at by the hooligans, who even looted their luggage. Eventually, the French army was able to get the crowd off the runway and protect their departing nationals. Now they are all gathered outside the terminal, obstructing the highway and being perfect nuisances. The tense situation in the country has thousands swarming into the few supermarkets open, buying up all the foodstuff available and emptying the shelves. Christy Okudwa for Radio France International in Abidjan.
Ivorian Defense Minister Bertrand Cadé said that French troops should have informed him before taking up positions at the airport. He spoke to RFI from Abidjan.
Because I'm the responsible of the defense, of the security in Ivory Coast, I must be consulted.
Meanwhile, the UN has warned that the humanitarian situation in neighboring Côte d'Ivoire is very serious. Burkina Faso's social development minister said that more than 100,000 Burkinabes have left Côte d'Ivoire since the beginning of the crisis. Both Côte d'Ivoire's Prime Minister Pascal Affi N'Guessan and Seydou Diarra, the man designated to replace him in an interim government, were expected at today's summit of the Economic Community of West African States in Dakar, Senegal, but neither attended the summit's opening ceremony. As correspondent Amadou Tiadiane C reports from Dakar, Côte d'Ivoire was top of the agenda at the summit.
In his opening speech, President Abdoulaye Wade, currently ECOWAS chairman, renewed his commitment to find a solution to the Ivorian crisis. Several actors of this conflict are currently in Dakar and may be met later by the heads of state. The Ivorian crisis has overshadowed all other important issues that were supposed to be dealt with in Dakar, namely the creation of a second monetary zone. At the end of the ministerial meeting yesterday, the ministers insisted they will propose to the heads of states the creation of an ECOWAS peace fund so as to be able to face the conflicts in the region. Amadou Tijansi, RFI, Dakar.
A court in Maputo, Mozambique, has sentenced six men accused of murdering a prominent investigative journalist 2 years ago to between 23 and 28 years in prison. The six men were accused of organizing and perpetrating the murder of journalist Carlos Cardoso in the year 2000 while he was investigating the disappearance of around $14 million from the country's national bank. Correspondent Fernando Lima was at the courthouse in Maputo.
The six defendants were condemned to the total of 146 years in prison. Basically, they were being accused of homicide, and the tribunal here, the court, just convicted the six of them. Of course, there are a number of other individuals that are still being investigated, but they are not part of this process. And so this will be definitely another matter in the next coming weeks.
One of the guilty was arrested in Pretoria, South Africa, by Interpol today. Anibal Antonio dos Santos Jr. had escaped from a Mozambican jail last September. A magistrates' court in Pretoria said dos Santos had agreed to return to Mozambique voluntarily. Our correspondent says he is believed to have already arrived in Maputo. A meeting to consolidate a truce between Burundi's transitional government and a main Hutu rebel group failed to take place today after the government delegation did not show up, according to a rebel source. The Secretary-General, Rajabu Hussein, for the Forces for the Defense of Democracy, said he had expected to work out the finer points of the ceasefire today. A deal paving the way to peace was agreed in Arusha in December between President Pierre Buyoya and rebel leader Pierre Nkurunziza. But Nicholas de Boerman from the non-government organization Cordaid says thousands of people are still being displaced from their Burundi farms because the ceasefire is not being honored.
The problem is the ceasefire, even though it has been reaffirmed by the government and the head of the opposition, the ceasefire is still not respected, so fightings are still going on in the country. Especially those days in Gitega province, people are displaced in a pretty bad humanitarian situation.
Nicholas Boerman from the humanitarian organisation Cordaid speaking from the Burundi capital, Bujumbura. The Angolan government has set up a service to prepare for its first general elections since the end of a 27-year civil war. RFI's Alice Moss reports.
Territorial Administration Minister Faustino Muteka said the service had been set up to prepare technical and logistical requirements for conducting a census of electors. Muteka said that now the war in Angola was over, the ministry had to get organized and lead moves linked to the elections. One of the priorities would be arranging the census of voters. The Angolan government has proposed holding general elections early next year. President José Eduardo dos Santos has said he's begun consultations with political and civil groups to agree a date. The country's last general elections were in September 1992. Those were won by dos Santos's Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, but challenged by the Rebel Union for the Total Independence of Angola movement. The war officially ended in April last year, 6 weeks after UNITA leader Jonas Savimbi was killed in combat.
Zambia's former finance minister, Katale Kaluba, is due to give evidence today in a corruption trial against President Levi Mwanawasawa. On Thursday, the former head of the Zambia Intelligence Service, Xavier Chungu, gave his evidence in the trial. Five people were killed and several injured when robbers raided several commercial buses in northern Nigeria. State-run radio said the incident occurred on Thursday at Kotokoshi in Zamafara State when the bandits attacked 10 buses on a trip to nearby Kano State. The bandits fired sporadically before robbing the passengers of cash and valuables. An investigation set up over a year ago to probe allegations that Ugandan officials had plundered resources in the DRC has been handed to the Kampala government. Junior Foreign Minister Tom Butime promised the report will shortly be made public. A copy of it's also being sent to the United Nations. A UN-appointed team accused 54 people, including senior military and political officials in Rwanda, Uganda, Zimbabwe and the DRC itself, of leading elite networks which exploited the DRC's natural wealth. The report recommended imposing sanctions on them and financial restrictions on 29 companies, four in Belgium, it alleges were carrying out multi-billion dollar corporate theft. Iraq says majority support at the United Nations for more weapons inspections is a resounding failure for the United States. As the US and Britain prepare for war on Iraq, Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington for meetings with top officials, and in particular President George W. Bush. He says the weapons inspections in Iraq should continue for some weeks more. UN weapons inspectors are insisting on greater cooperation from Iraq in their search for arms of mass destruction. This was underlined by Mohammed Al-Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Spokesman Mark Gwozdecki speaks from the agency's headquarters in Vienna, Austria.
Dr. Al-Baradei made it very clear that he and Dr. Blix are going to do everything possible to move forward to make the inspections effective. If the visit can help, he's quite willing to do it. What he's hoping to get soon is some positive indication from the Iraqis that they plan to indicate how they are willing to address the key issues that we've been putting on the table that need to be resolved. A couple of the issues on the table are the use of private one-on-one interviews, the use of aerial surveillance aircraft, and also bringing forward evidence to help resolve outstanding questions in the realm of chemical and biological weapons and missiles.
Mark Gwozdecki at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, Austria. Israeli troops have struck out at Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza as Prime Minister Ariel Sharon opens talks to form a new government. Two Palestinians were killed early today in Jenin, where Israeli tanks returned 3 days after their previous operation. The Israelis destroyed more homes of suspected militants. Soldiers and tanks are still occupying the southern western West Bank town of Hebron, where they roared in yesterday. RFI spoke to Naim Bayo, spokesman for Hebron University. The crisis in Côte d'Ivoire all but eclipsed other issues at today's summit of the Economic Community of West African States in Dakar, Senegal. A dozen West African leaders and rebel representatives from Côte d'Ivoire attended. Ivorian Prime Minister Pascal Affi N'Guessan and Seydou Diarra, the man designated to replace him in an interim government, were expected to be there. RFI's Henry Samuel asked Dakar correspondent Amadou Tidiane Si whether the two turned up.
They were supposed, at least one of them was supposed to be in Dakar and to meet the delegation, that is outgoing Prime Minister Pascal Affi N'Guessan. He was supposed to speak to the heads of state on behalf of President Laurent Gbagbo. That's what he told us yesterday after meeting with President Ouad. As to Seydou Diarra, I mean the new Prime Minister, he was supposed to leave Dakar and go back to Abidjan, but as you know, the situation is very tense there, namely at the airport, where some people have protested and showed hostility, saying they don't want him to come back home. But what is sure, none of the two officially represented Ivory Coast at the opening ceremony.
Now, Abdoulaye Iouad said that the Ivorian president, Laurent Gbagbo, told him that the ministers there should help bring about a resumption of discussions. What do you think he means by that, and what role can leaders here play in the Ivorian crisis?
Yes, I think the feeling here is Marcosi. I mean, the Marcosi Accord signed in France has almost failed, and people need to take over the peace process to start it again, or at least to save Marcosi. I mean, that was the main issue in the talks yesterday between President Ouad and the rebels. The talks with President Ouad and Pascal Affi N'Guessan, whom we mentioned earlier.
Gbagbo's statement there that they should help bring about a resumption of discussions, is that in a way him saying that Marcosi is dead in the water?
Pascal Affi N'Guessan told they still want Marcosi to be alive, but the problem, the facts out there is Marcosi is not working because the rebels, they want a holistic approach to this issue. They don't want a part of Marcosi to be implemented and another part of it to be buried. And I think that is now the big question, how the West African heads of states can say, okay, Marcosi will operate. We'll try and see how to implement Marcosi, and at the same time, please, the rebels who are saying they want everything that was signed there to be put in place. And on the other hand, you have Gbagbo saying, okay, he can agree to Marcosi, but not to a part of it that is the sharing of portfolios in the future government.
Correspondent Amadou Tidjane-Si in Dakar. A meeting to consolidate the truce between Burundi's transitional government and a main Hutu rebel group has failed to take place today after the government delegation did not show up. That's according to a rebel source. A deal paving the way to peace was agreed in Arusha last December between President Pierre Buyoya and rebel leader Pierre Nkurunziza. However, the non-government organization Cordaid says the ceasefire is already being broken. Cordaid says that while the fighting has displaced 60,000 people in Gitega province alone, rebel forces are now asking for food. RFI's Alice Moss asked the group's Nicholas de Bourman why they can't respond.
We met together and we decided that we should follow the international humanitarian law, and also most of those NGOs have ethical regulations that does not allow us to provide food to armed forces. And so even if providing food and medical supplies to rebels might be good points in order to reach a complete ceasefire and a full stop in the fightings, international NGOs have refused to do so.
Why have you refused if you think it could help hold the ceasefire?
It was something we should think about. I mean, we were split between or divided between being pragmatic and helping those people or following our own regulations. And at that point, we thought it was a bit dangerous for ourselves to do it right away without without thinking and without major reflection about this.
Meanwhile, Nicholas, ordinary people who have been displaced by the conflicts have had to abandon their farms. And what is happening to the crops in Burundi at the moment? There is a small drought, you're saying.
Yeah.
But people can't even grow or harvest their own food, such as it is.
Some areas are just closed by the military armed forces to any international support. Burundi is particular in that sense that the livelihoods, the households are not established in villages, but just spread all around the country, and so the people are fixing themselves around administrative centers and in more secured areas around Gitega town, for instance, or smaller villages.
Nicholas Bourman from the humanitarian organization Cordaid speaking from the Burundi capital, Bujumbura. Thailand and neighboring Cambodia are trying to mend relations after mob attacks on Thai businesses and legations in Cambodia. Cambodia has formally apologized after several hundred of its nationals went on a rampage on Thursday. The Cambodian government has also agreed to pay full compensation for damages estimated at around $1 billion. The riot was caused by false allegations that a Thai actress had claimed Cambodia's historic Angkor Wat temple complex for Thailand. Salil Sarkar talked to Kavi Chongkitavorn, assistant editor of the Nation Multimedia Group in Bangkok.
Cambodian government has not yet provided the full
details of what happened, and the government has to deal with the culprits who are behind this attack of the Thai embassy and Thai business premises.
$1 billion of dollars worth of damage is a lot, but how did this thing start in the first place? There is this actress who was supposed to have said that Angkor Wat belonged to Thailand, then she denies this ever having said it. So who started this rumor? Because that's what it is. It a rumor? That's what it looks like.
I think it's a combination. The rumor was used as a vehicle to form the fans of anti-Thai's sentiment, and it was quickly spread amongst the young students through leaflets and also through a radio program which spread the rumor that Cambodian citizens were killed in Thailand, that the embassy in Bangkok has been burned down. So a combination of factors, and also the lack of law enforcement in Cambodia, the sluggishness of the security force that come to protect the Thai embassy, and also you thrown in also the domestic politics, you have a lot of factors. So I think it's a combination of factors.
Would you say that the Cambodian government failed to react, or failed to react fast enough?
I think that the government should be blamed. I think the government failed to provide security that the Thai embassy has requested. I think it was the Cambodian responsibility to meet all the requirements to make sure that the diplomatic corps, such as Thailand, is safe and secure. I think the government of Cambodia fails to provide such safety. And I think that the government realized that is why it came out quickly that it will try to find the culprit and also pay the compensation.
Mm. Now, last thing, the Cambodian government apologized. Okay, but why couldn't they move against the rioters in the first place? If I remember right, Prime Minister Hun Sen even came out and condemned the actress for this Angkor Wat claim, did he not?
Yes, I think that was his mistake, and I think he tried to remedial his position. That is why he came out very quickly, agreed to the Thai's demand without any condition, and agree to have Thailand sending their own investigative team of what happening in Phnom Penh.
Kavi Chongkita Vaughan, assistant editor of the Nation Multimedia Group in Bangkok.
Today in France, David Page.
A letter published yesterday in the conservative newspapers, the Wall Street Journal and the Times of London, and signed by eight European leaders, has opened a can of worms. The letter supported George Bush's Iraq policy. The letter was not signed by French President Jacques Chirac, nor by German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, who are firmly committed to United Nations approval before a military invasion of Iraq. Bruno Jambard of the CSA polling organization says the French government position is in sync with French popular opinion.
We now have around 75-80% of the French who say that they do not want the U.S. especially to go in the war in Iraq. And we also notice that now most of the French think that if the United Nations Council has to vote for a war in Iraq, as we know now from the United Nations inspectors, the French would like that the French government use its veto right in the United Nations Council.
Have you made any contrast between French public opinion and other European nations?
Well, what is really interesting is that the fact that Donald Rumsfeld talk about the difference between the old Europe, symbolized by Germany and France, and the other new European countries, is not really verified in the surveys. What we see in the European surveys is that most of the European countries are against a war in Iraq, even in Hungary or Poland or Czechoslovakia. We notice this tendency everywhere.
Prominent political analyst and foreign policy advisor Dominique Moisy says the French government's position is the closest to that of European public opinion.
The French were saying that they were speaking in the name of the United Europe. They may be speaking for European public opinion, but clearly not for European governments.
That's a very important distinction you're making there, because of the eight nations that signed this letter that was published in the press, public opinion in most of those countries don't support necessarily the positions of their governments, does it?
Exactly. France speaks in the name of the common European public opinion, which is a conflict. But European governments are divided deeply as to what to do towards the United States.
Now, if the scenario that everybody is hoping for, which would be that Saddam Hussein resigns, doesn't actually happen, which is probably not going to happen, has France and Germany painted themselves into a corner?
Well, they have made their situation difficult. But France and Germany are not saying the same things. When Germany is opposed to war, any war, France is saying no war without a mandate, no mandate without an evidence. So I don't think one should assimilate the French and the German position, even if right now they look together.
Now, if the United States comes out once again with their famous evidence next week, could we expect a surprising flip-flop in the French position with Mr. de Villepin saying, oh, now the evidence looks incontournable?
Well, if that's the case, which is unlikely, the French would join. The problem is that the evidence will probably be murky, gray, not black and white. And so the French will stay to their position.
So in addition to the problem of disarming Iraq, we now have a situation where Europe has been more or less divided on the political level, and French-American relations have been strained further than in the past.
Yes, I think the first casualty of a war that has not yet started is transatlantic relations.
This has been Today in France. I'm David Page.
My thanks go to David Page for Today in France. From me, Richard Walker, and all the production team here at RFI, goodbye.